So God willing, over the next 4 weeks, we're going to present four different talks on this theme of hope. And if you were, the Christian hope that God will bring a solution to this world. He'll bring a solution to the issues that we all despair about, the problems that we see in society all around us. And so tonight is the first session in this series, and it's entitled Hope in the Darkness. And next week, Sunday, 7 p.m., same time, will be entitled with a different speaker, The Power of Faith and Hope. And then on November 17th, at the same time from this platform, we have yet a different speaker, and his subject will be Living with Hope. And then finally, we'll close the month on November 24th with A Call to Hope as our last session. And so we hope that you can follow along with us through these four different evenings. And the format is very simple. We're just going to have a short introduction, which is what I'm doing right now. And then our speaker for tonight will present the topic. We'll have a quick wrap-up. We'll close in prayer, and then we can break to the back room. And you have an opportunity to speak with any one of us, certainly our speaker, members of our community, and ask questions about the things that we have presented. The question is, what is hope? You know, we use the term often, you know, but I think usually for trivial things, like, you know, I hope the bus isn't going to be late, or maybe more recently, I hope the turkey's not going to be overdone. But we as a race of human beings, I think generally are hopeful people, but I think over the last few years, certainly over the last generation, we have weathered a number of storms in our society and around the world. And as the world has gone up and down with these issues, I think we find ourselves in a place where we think, why is humanity not improving? You know, we're still at war with each other, sadly. We have more social issues now than I think ever before. And in a recent study that came out just in April of this year, it revealed this sense of growing hopelessness and pessimism. This organization called Glocalites published in April of this year, surveyed over 300,000 people in over 20 countries around the world. And the findings revealed this very significant increase in despair and disillusionment in the state of world affairs. So clearly there is a growing problem of hopelessness. And you only have to walk the streets of this beautiful city to see that happening, sadly, in real time. Vince Lombardi, the famous U.S. football coach, once said, "Hope is not a strategy." Now, in saying that, it may seem counterintuitive to our subject for this month, but in one sense, it is true. We cannot go about life just hoping that things will get better. And while this sentiment is a reminder that victories, whether they be on the field or whether they be in our life, require intentional preparation and action on our part. For those of us that have a faith in God, hope is something far deeper, far more meaningful. Hope, like faith, is not a substitute for planning, but an anchor that holds firm even when those strategies fail and the storms of life pull against us. It is a hope in God's intentional planning that we need to rest our faith. Now, we've used this phrase, anchored in hope. Does anybody know what verse in the Bible we've pulled that phrase from? No? Well, it comes from Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 19. And in this particular chapter, this section, the writer's talking about the promises that God has made to bring salvation to all of mankind, to bring solutions to a world in despair. And the promises that God has given us is the hope of the future, the hope of the future kingdom, a kingdom that will bring peace and equity. I'm just going to read a short section from Hebrews chapter 6. And the writer says, "To those who were to receive what he promised, God wanted to make it very clear that he would never change his purpose. So he added his vow to his promise. So we who have found safety with him are greatly encouraged to hold firmly to the hope placed before us. And so we have this hope as an anchor for our lives. And that hope is safe and secure." And so the Christian hope of the Bible, this anchor in our lives, is that we believe that God will bring about what he has promised. A solution to the world's problems. A resolution to man's despair. And so in this world of hopelessness and endless bad news, we endeavor to bring this message of hope to you this night and in the subsequent next three nights, that we might have faith in God's promise and that he will bring us through the storm to a better day. And so if you stay with us over the next 4 weeks, and I hope you will, God willing, we can bring that message from God's word to you, because unlike this fleeting optimism, the faith in God strengthens us, grounds our lives in this unshakable truth about God's future. So tonight, I want to introduce our first speaker. His name is Mark Hunter, and he's a member of our community out in Sydney, where he resides with his wife and his family. And so I invite him to present to us tonight, Hope in the Darkness. Mark?
Okay, let me do a bit of a sound check, make sure my equipment is working properly. Good evening. The Grand Canyon gets 6 million visitors a year. It's one of the most dramatic, epic landmarks in North America. Has anybody here been to the Grand Canyon? Oh, look at that. Like just from this room, we've got at least a dozen or two dozen. Now, if you look down into the depths of the Grand Canyon, anybody know what you see there? You're going to have to speak up and be brave, because... Okay, water, thank you. Do you have a specific name for that body of water?
Colorado.
The Colorado River. Okay, and if we take a slightly zoom in and get a nicer picture of the Colorado River, this is what it looks like. And it's actually a big basin that the Colorado River drains. This is called the Upper Basin, which includes New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah. And you see it gathers the water from this all this area, and then it channels it into the Lower Basin, which is Nevada, Arizona, and California. And then here at the very end, we get the Gulf of California, which paradoxically is in Mexico. So if you look at the very top, it all begins in what they call the Never Summer Mountains, which is not somewhere that I want to go. But if you go to this pond, right, in theory, you can put a little message in a bottle and you can toss it into that pond and it's going to flow all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, not the Gulf of Mexico, it's a different Gulf, the Gulf of California. And along the way, it's going to pull in all the water from all those tributaries that you saw of that enormous piece of land, which is drained by this water system, until we get to the very bottom. And I just want to remind you what the Colorado River looked like sort of towards the beginning of our journey, because when you get to the very end of the journey, this is what the mighty Colorado River looks like. There is literally more water flowing down the curb in front of my house after a few hours of light rain in Sydney than you get in the Colorado River after draining that entire watershed and funneling it down towards Mexico. And this is all that's left. How can that be? Where did all that water go? We just took and we took and we took and we took so much of the Colorado River that we practically destroyed the entire river. There's effectively nothing left by the time you get to the end. And this is what humanity does on this planet, right? We find a beautiful resource and then we take from it and we take from it and we take some more, and very often there's nothing left. And it's not just the Colorado River. If you go to China, you got the Yangtze River. Now this one's not dried out, but you certainly don't want to take a drink from that river, okay? There's a lot of crazy chemicals that have been poured into that river. You can go into India where you find the enormous mountains of garbage, right? And they have whole groups of people that burn and melt and extract little bits of garbage from there. It's not just this. Deforestation, microplastics, endangered species, CO2 levels, extreme weather. I mean, we're making a really big mess of this planet. So how do we fix this? Well, if we look at Jeremiah chapter 29, it says, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. So as bad as the environmental situation is on this planet, we need to keep this verse in mind. God has a plan for you, and that plan is for welfare, not for calamity. To have a future and a hope. And if we go to Isaiah 35, it says, the wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad. This is a forward-looking vision. The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice. Now, why would this verse talk about wilderness and wasteland and desert? Anybody brave enough to venture a guess? We're projecting into the vision of the future, and we're reading about wastelands. Why would it say that? Because that's what you're going to find in the future of this planet, is wilderness and wastelands and deserts, right? This, what's happening in the world today, is not a surprise to God. It's not like, oh no, what are they doing? Like, this was written thousands of years ago. It was understood. This is the condition that the earth is going to be in. And you know what? It's going to blossom like a rose. In fact, the next verse says, strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong. Do not fear. Behold, your God will come with a vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. There's a tremendous epidemic of fear around the state of the environment. And I'm trying to convince you tonight that God anticipated the environmental problems on this planet, and He intends to remedy them. They will not get so bad as to destroy us all. We don't need to be afraid. We shouldn't be reckless. We shouldn't pour paint thinner down the drain. Right? But we shouldn't worry that somehow there's going to be a catastrophic global disaster that we're all going to die. This is not what's going to happen. The wilderness will bloom. Now we might ask ourselves, why is the environment in such a mess? And the answer is because human governments are such a mess. This is a picture of the actual Colorado River Compact of 1922. Okay, they typed it up back in the old days, right? So you got the Colorado River Compact of 1922. They got all these states together and they decided, what are we going to do with the Colorado River? Right? And if you look at the fine print there, now I have to zoom in on that. Maybe I'll turn around. The major purposes of this compact are to provide for the equitable division and apportionment of the use of the waters of the Colorado River system, to establish the relative importance of different beneficial uses of the water, to promote interstate comity, to remove causes of present and future controversies. And so on and so forth. It talks about equitable down here as well. Very interesting, okay? So it's definitely a beautifully written document. Like, who could argue that the waters of the Colorado River should be used equitably, right? The question is, not what is best, but who shall decide what is best? This is an economist, Thomas Sowell, and he says, the most basic question is not what is best, but who shall decide? Now, when it comes to the Colorado River, there is something called the prior appropriation doctrine. And you can read about it in the California Legislative Information. We got Water Code Division 2, Part 2, Chapter 7, Article 1, Paragraph 1450. And it says, any application properly made gives to the applicant a priori of right as of the date of the application. Now, when you were a kid, maybe you were going for the teeter-totter in the playground, right? And there's somebody already on the teeter-totter, and they would say, first come, first serve, right? Like, we got here first. And if they got there first, I guess they get to use the teeter-totter, and too bad for you, right? This is the legal equivalent of that situation, okay? First in time, first in right is what that's called. Which brings me to this picture. Does anybody recognize what is in this picture? You will have to be bold and speak up, because I can hear the murmurings of the audience, but not any clear signal. Almonds. Excellent. It's an almond orchard. Almond orchards were started in California in the year, anybody want to guess? 1870. Remember what we said? First come, first serve. Well, guess who's really early in this game is the almond orchards starting in 1870. In the past 30 years, the yield of almond orchards in California has quadrupled to the point where California now supplies 80% of the global market in almonds. I mean, it's a fantastic success story. And it so happens that in my back pocket, I have an almond. And so I ask you, how much water did it take to grow this almond?
1 gallon.
Is that Mike? Yeah. Okay, we've got Mike at 1 gallon. Anybody else want to put in a vote or a bid? 10 gallons. 1,000. Now you guys are ambitious. Yeah. Well, this is 1 gallon of water. Mike wins the prize. You can have the almond after when we're done. So to grow this one almond, you need this much water. Right? So now think about that when you buy a little pack of almonds for your snack, right? Or you order your almond mocha frappuccino, right? Like, think of how much water is going in to make that almond. So the question is, how many almonds do you think an acre of almond orchard can produce? So you think of the size of an acre and think of those beautiful almond trees.
Number of almonds.
So this is 5 almonds, 5 gallon jug. How many almonds are you going to get out of that acre of almond orchard?
Who is that?
1 million almonds from 1 acre of almond orchard. Another trivia question. How many acres of almond orchards do you think there are in California? Not expecting you to know, so you can throw it a guess. You could just, I don't know. Going once, going...
10,000 acres.
How many?
10,000.
10,000 acres. Okay, anybody... do better than 10,000 acres from that? 100,000. 1,630,000. 1.6. Did you look it up? Cheater. 1.6 million acres of almond orchards in California. Now you're going to have to do some math now, and there's a lot of zeros involved. How many gallons of water per acre? Do the math. How many? A million. So if we got 1 million gallons of water for every acre, and we have 1.6 million acres, how many gallons of water does it take to feed California's almond orchards? 1.6 trillion gallons of water every year. And according to the California Water Code, first in time, first in right. So they get to soak as much of that up. And if there's none left for Mexico at the end, well, that's too bad for Mexico, right? Now, there isn't 1.6 trillion gallons in the Colorado River, right? Like, you would, if you want to think of how much 1.6 trillion gallons is, imagine you take Mount Everest from sea level to top, and you hollow the whole thing out, right? And you cut a little hole in the top, and you pour in the Colorado River. You pour in the whole Colorado River for 4 months in order to fill that up. That's how much water is being spent on your almond mocha frappuccino. That is crazy. Now, the Colorado River Compact, what year was it from again? 1922. Is it not insane to take a document from 1922 when there were only 3 million people in California, never mind in the other states, right? When there were just a few almond orchards, but no, we gotta spend our water according to 100-year-old documents. What happens? Well, they try to change it, and then there's lawsuits, and the almond, you know, farmers are railing against the alfalfa, and in between, no more Colorado River, right? We just soak up the whole Colorado River. It's crazy Americans. Now, surely Canadians wouldn't do silly things like that. This is a screen grab from a video of a Canadian dairy farmer. And he's doing something quite natural, which is drinking a cup of milk, which is what you would expect a dairy farmer might do. But there's a very curious thing going on down here in the bottom right corner. You ever know what that is? He is dumping thousands of liters of milk down the drain. Now that seems kind of counterintuitive, right? Like, it takes a lot of effort. You gotta buy some land, and you gotta get some cows and a lot of expensive machine, and then you gotta feed them, and you gotta up in the morning and vet bills, and you do all that work to collect all that milk, and then you literally pump it down the drain. 7% of all milk produced in Canada gets dumped down the drain. It's estimated that 6 billion liters of Canadian milk have been poured down the drain since 2012. 6 billion liters. They went to all that trouble of collecting that milk, and then they pour it down the drain. How many of you were aware that the government of Canada is supporting this behavior? A handful. Now that in itself is fascinating, right? In Psalm 146:3, it says, "Do not trust in politicians." Well, it doesn't say politicians, but, you know, princes. "In mortal man in whom there is no salvation." Right, the government is fully supporting this and endorsing it, and it's not really letting the population know that this is going on. By contrast, in March 2023, that's last year, there were over 1.9 million visits to the food banks in Canada. So we have in Canada this absurd paradox where we invest all this time to produce all this nutritious milk. And on the one hand, we pour it down the drain. And on the other hand, there are millions of visits to the food bank because people can't afford food. What kind of insanity is this? Thomas Sowell said, "The most basic question is not what is best, but who shall decide what is best? And is it the Canadian Dairy Commission who decides what is best, or is it the Food Banks of Canada who decide what is best? Because they're going to come to quite different decisions." Now, what I've described to you tonight are two laws. Two laws. How many laws do you think there are in the United States, for instance? I'm winning the trivia tonight. The short answer, there are so many laws that nobody knows how many laws there are. They actually paid some researchers to spend years trying to find just one narrow category of law. They tried to find just the federal criminal laws in the United States. And there's the whole federal, and then there's the state, and then there's the city, and then there's municipal. Right? And they spent years to try to pin down about 3,000 laws, but afterwards they were told, they said, "You will have died and been resurrected three times and still not have an answer to the question of how many laws there are." Right? There is an insane amount of laws. And we've got two of them, and they date back a long time, and they're clearly broken, and nobody seems to be able to fix them. How are we going to fix the hundreds of thousands of broken laws that are clogging up the legal systems of U.S. and Canada? Well, it turns out that God has a plan. "I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not calamity, to give you a future and a hope." We are not going to get suffocated by the legal systems and the governments of the world, right? God has a plan, a future, and a hope, and the legal dimension has been considered as well. And we'll look at Isaiah again, this time in chapter 2, verse 2. "And many people will come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion.'" So the legal systems of the world, with their hundreds of years of obsolete and obstinate laws, are just going to be replaced. "The law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will render decisions between many peoples." So this question of who gets to decide will be sorted out when the law comes out from Jerusalem. Now, ironically, the next verse in that chapter, we love this verse, "They will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war." Where is this verse inscribed? Does anybody know where that monument is?
Yes.
United Nations. So the United Nations really likes this verse. They don't like the verse before. Right? They don't quote, "Out of Zion shall go forth the law." That one is not cool. This one is cool. So they're trying to implement this verse. And how's that going for them? Do you guys know? It's not going very well, right? It's a bit of a struggle. And I have some interesting United Nations groups here. This is the United Nations Human Rights Council, and I extracted some of the members of the Human Rights Council. We've got China and Cuba are members of the UN Human Rights Council. And if you know much about China and Cuba, you will find that very surprising. And then they also have this Commission on the Status of Women. And two of the member states there, Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. And if you know much about the status of women in Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia, you know that this is tremendously ironic. So they've set up this whole institution, and it's a farce. So we might ask ourselves, why is human government such a mess? Well, it's easy to point the finger, right? It's easy to look at someone else and say, you know, you should do a better job, and the rules you make are ridiculous. As my friend Don Blacker used to say, every time you point the finger at someone else, there's three fingers pointing back at you. And so if I think about how I manage my own life, how am I doing, right? I don't want you asking me how I've managed my affairs. Don't ask me how much time I've spent scrolling through social media. Don't ask me how much TV I've watched or time wasted on sports. Don't ask me how much money I've spent on selfish hobbies. Don't ask me how many times I've had petty or judgmental thoughts. Don't ask me how often I've been impatient with my children and my wife. Don't ask me how often I've been short-sighted and made rash decisions, not understanding what I was doing. For what I am doing, I don't understand. I'm not practicing what I would like to do, but I'm doing the very thing I hate. For the good that I want, I do not do. But I practice the very evil I do not want. Wretched man that I am, who will set me free from this body, from the body of this death? This is Romans chapter 7. This is Paul. And Paul the apostle is looking at his life and saying, you know what? It's really easy to see when everybody else is making terrible decisions. And I can even look at myself and say, you are making terrible decisions. And you can tell yourself you're doing them. And then you wake up the next day and you're still doing it. You're still making all these terrible decisions. And it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. The most basic question is not what is best, but who shall decide what is best? And in the Garden of Eden, the temptation was there. You will be like God, deciding good and evil, right? We love to make our own decisions about good and evil. We want to take that away from God, and we want to own it ourselves, and we create a mess of it. Romans chapter 6. Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin resulting in death or of obedience resulting in righteousness? So we think we're freeing ourselves from God by taking it on ourselves to decide what is right and wrong. But what we find out is that we use our human selfish passions to decide what is right and wrong. And rather than being free, we end up being slaves. And there is a sad and inspiring parable that Jesus tells about this. It's called the parable of the prodigal son. And you have a son who's in his father's house and everything is great, very much like the Garden of Eden, right? Everything's provided, everything's going well. And the son goes to his father and says, I want to take all these blessings you have. I want to take a portion of them and I'm going to go somewhere else and I'm going to spend them how I see fit. And very oddly in the parable, the father says, sure, go ahead. Take the stuff. Take my stuff. Take this world that I have made. Take these rivers. Take these people and these circumstances, the riches that you have. Go ahead. Go and do what seems right to you. And so the son does that. And you know, for a while, it seems like a really good idea. Right? Initially, it seems like it's going pretty well. But at the end, you always end up in a big mess. You always end up in a deep hole. You always end up consuming and destroying more than you create. Why does God let us do this? Why does God let governments do this? Why is God letting the planet do this? Because He is hoping that we will reach a point where we look at the mess we've made and we say to ourselves, you know what? It's better in my Father's house. It's better in my Father's house. This being a slave to my own passions isn't quite as rewarding as I thought. How do we fix the fact that everything we touch, we seem to ruin or taint somehow? I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Now, do you think God is surprised that you make all kinds of silly mistakes all the time? You think God is surprised that you're selfish and he's like, oh no, my plan's going to go sideways because it turns out man's selfish sometimes. No. Okay, God knew this was going to happen. It's not a big surprise. It's not like the whole train is going off the tracks. 2 Corinthians 5:17, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creature. The old things have passed away. Behold, new things have come. And in Romans chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death. You see, God has put us in this system and he's given us the option to mess it up to a certain degree so that we can learn how our ways are destructive and his ways are restorative. And the goal is for us to turn to him, at which point we will be set free from the law of sin and death. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. There is a future and a hope for the environment. We don't have to panic. It doesn't mean we're personally reckless, but we don't have to panic that the whole thing is going to freeze over in some kind of cataclysm. And there is a plan for the world governments. We don't have to panic about how this election is going to turn out next week. And it may go this way, it may go that. God has a plan. It's going to be okay. And we don't have to panic about the fact that when we look at ourselves in the mirror, we're not who we wish we were. God knows that, is willing to work with us on that. And he has a plan for our welfare, not for calamity, to give us a future and a hope.